Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, March 12th, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, preceptor and public speaking for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, a former U.S. Army officer and State Department diplomat who taught at Bard College for 6 years and is now a senior fellow at Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Ambassador Fred Hoff, and professor emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University and author of A Liberal Vanguard, Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia, Alexander Mihailovich.
The Ukraine peace talks, the U.S. and Ukraine start peace talks as Moscow and Kyiv trade strikes. This is the latest. There was, of course, I think the last time Alexander was here was just after the unfortunate meeting between the president of Volodymyr Zelensky and President Trump in the Oval Office of the White House. Oval Office of the White House and Tesla dealership, that the Trump administration have lifted its pause on military and intelligence support for Ukraine on Tuesday after Kyiv endorsed an ambitious U.S. ceasefire proposal aimed at initiating an end to the three-year war. The agreement resulting from more than 8 hours of meetings between U.S. and Ukrainian officials in Saudi Arabia dramatically improves Kyiv's war footing and lessens a transatlantic divide between U.S. and European allies that had plunged to new lows. The Ukrainian delegation today made something very clear that they share President Trump's vision for peace. They share his determination to end the fighting, to end the killing, to end the tragic meat grinder of people. That, according to White House National Security Advisor Michael Waltz, who spoke after the meetings. The mere fact that U.S. and Ukrainian officials were able to agree on a joint statement, much less one of substance, marked a significant improvement in relations after the row between President Trump and President Zelensky in the Oval Office and the abrupt suspension of U.S. support for Kyiv. That from the Washington Post. Alexander Mihailovich, let's begin with you as far as what you make of this move forward. The lifting of the pause is one part of it. The ceasefire proposal is another part of it. I guess we have to look at them somewhat separately, don't we?
Somewhat separately, yes. I think one thing to bear in mind is that Zelensky was essentially playing hardball, and he actually won this round. In my view, what happened on February 28th was really a massive self-own in terms of the Trump administration, because they wanted Zelensky to go ahead and, as I mentioned last time I was here, to go ahead and sign this agreement, the mineral deal, with no security guarantees in place. The security part of the agreement was being written as the meeting in the Oval Office was taking place. And as I mentioned last time, it's Zelensky was doing, whatever one might feel about Zelensky and his policies, he was doing what any responsible leader would do, which is he's not going to sign on the dotted line without seeing what all the provisions are. So that's one thing. You mentioned Mike Waltz. The thing about Waltz is that 2 weeks earlier, about a week prior to the Oval Office meeting, Waltz was insisting to Zelensky, you just have to sign this deal. Again, the security guarantees were not included in the deal.
Right.
And Zelensky understandably balked. So what this really represents is a kind of a back and forth in negotiation, which is the part of any serious deliberation process. And Zelensky has truly come to the fore, and he's been playing hardball about this in the sense that he has, A, refused to sign, B, did not agree to a complete and utter ceasefire from Ukraine as long as Russia was not doing the same. So he stepped up his military efforts, and as a result, the Trump administration is now coming back to the table. So I think, without taking sides one way or the other about this, I think what both sides of this negotiation have been doing is going back and forth and seeing not so much what people say, but what they do. And so this is a constructive step forward. It needs to be said that a lot can happen between now and Friday, because on Friday, Steve Witkoff is supposed to go to Moscow to meet with Vladimir Putin to come to a determination of whether or not the Russian Federation will also engage in a ceasefire. As of this morning, Ukraine has abided by the ceasefire. Russia, technically speaking, has not, all right, although its military offensive operations are significantly scaled down as of yesterday. They're now completely confined to Kursk, where there is still battling between the Russian and Ukrainian forces. Kursk, by the way, is within the Russian side of the border. So far, so good. Let's see what happens by Friday. If hostilities remain at this level, which is relatively low, I think that's a good development.
We are talking this morning with our amazing panel about the U.S. lifting its pause on Ukraine aid as Kyiv agrees to ceasefire proposal. We heard from Alexander Mihailovich, and we now go to Terry Gibson. Terry.
Well, first, I'm just really grateful that you have this Russian expert on air today. It's really helpful to hear his perspective, and I really appreciate that. From my perspective, just being your sort of average American who isn't an expert on Russia, but who has lived through an entire term of Donald Trump, I just don't see any reason to trust any of the characters in the Trump administration that are out there negotiating this deal. Even if Marco Rubio and Mike Waltz are able to make some kind of headway, I would expect any day now Donald Trump will put something up on Truth Social that will contradict whatever they've said and throw the whole deal into chaos, which seems to be his standard pattern with all negotiating deals. So it wouldn't surprise me if this whole episode doesn't even make it into the day today before Donald Trump does something to mess up the works.
Well, that possibility always exists, right? I mean, it's kind of baked into the equation, right, Fred?
Yeah, I think it is. The president's approach to diplomacy is unusual. It's coercive and very unpredictable. And I guess one really doesn't know. I mean, perhaps the president knows. I certainly don't know whether there is a sharply defined objective, an endpoint, and a strategy in pursuit of that objective. It's very, very, very difficult to know. But look, I think Alexander has it exactly right when it comes to Zelensky's diplomatic recovery from the humiliation he was subjected to in the Oval Office. Ukraine's acceptance of this U.S. ceasefire proposal has only one condition, and that is that Russia accept it also. And this, it seems to me, would put the onus on Vladimir Putin to preserve his relationship with Donald Trump. I can imagine Putin trying to condition his acceptance on an upfront, explicit reassurance that Ukraine will never become part of NATO. Ideally, President Trump, Special Envoy Witkoff will hold their ground and tell Putin that NATO is an issue for peace negotiations, which it should be. You know, ideally, the shooting will stop. for 30 days and peace talks can begin. What I can see emerging, if all goes well, is something short of formal peace between Ukraine and Russia. Perhaps an armistice that freezes military positions in place without requiring Ukraine to formally recognize Russian conquests. But the key, I think, to an enduring armistice or even a long ceasefire is security guarantees that Ukraine would be getting from the West. If NATO membership, for example, ends up being off the table, then something like a European peacekeeping force backed up by the United States will be necessary. I think we have to keep in mind, although I would acknowledge this is my personal opinion, is that Vladimir Putin's ultimate objective is the end of Ukraine. And unless that objective is blocked on the ground through future arrangements, Russian aggression, I think, will inevitably resume someday.
Yes, I completely agree. I think we have to bear in mind a couple of practical issues of NATO membership, which the first being, or the primary consideration, is that NATO membership can only happen if the entire bloc of NATO nations votes unanimously.
Yep.
At the present time, this is rather unlikely for the simple reason that Hungary, at the very least, will not vote for it. And this actually has been kind of a running pattern or sort of a really significant break on the possibility of NATO membership for Ukraine. All along the line, different countries, you know, would have at any number of points come forward and voted against membership. We're in a different time, different political moment vis-a-vis Ukraine and its possibility for becoming a member of NATO than we were, say, in 2022 and certainly in 2014. In 2014, with the Revolution of Dignity, when there was which took place in Kiev, which, you know, was essentially a kind of rebellion, a revolt against Russian hegemony over Ukrainian political affairs. The possibility of NATO membership was put forward in a speculative manner with the understanding that it probably would not become a reality because at that time, Germany and France would have voted against it, right? And the reasons for their voting against it had everything to do with the significant power of Russia's energy resources within the European Union. Gas and oil at that time were especially important for EU countries. Just to give one example, the Czech Republic, 61% of its energy resources at that time in 2014 were coming from the Russian Federation. Now, the map, the sort of the economic map of what energy resources EU countries are using right now has shifted from that time. But now you still have a practical obstacle to NATO membership, and that is really Hungary. I think it's really kind of like a good faith gesture to say that it's going to become a part of NATO's agenda items or action items. But the possibility of it actually happening in real terms, I think, are at this time nil. So I think that's one very important thing to bear in mind. The other aspect of this is, I think, you know, we talked about this the last time I appeared, you know, which was right after the Oval Office meeting, was, you know, a kind of an almost very bizarre, I would say, aesthetic dimension of what it is, you know, how the Trump administration conducts diplomacy. It's entirely ceremonial. It reminds me a little bit of Soviet journalistic accounts of, you know, meetings between Western leaders and Soviet and East Bloc leaders. It's a kind of these extensive descriptions of you know, the good feelings, people shaking hands, the flags are put out, but there's almost no granular detail about what is actually in those agreements.
Yeah.
The Trump administration is engaged in that kind of framing of issues, which, you know, on a very fundamental level is very shallow. And you're not talking about what, in practical terms, this or that agreement can move forward in a way that's going to be amenable to all the participants or signatories.
I want to get to Teresa. Just a quick follow-up question, though. When Secretary of State Marco Rubio talks about Ukrainian concessions and saying that the ceding of land is essential for a peace agreement, how big of a concession is that?
That's a huge concession. That's a huge concession. And from what I can tell, judging from the various statements of Rubio and other members of the Trump administration, what they have in mind is not just Crimea, but it's really the four other regions that are occupied by the Russian Federation right now, which are the Donbas, which is Luhansk and Donetsk, Zaporizhia and Kherson. That whole kind of hook-shaped segment of eastern and southeastern Ukraine, it's essentially occupied by the Russian Federation. And from what I can tell, the Trump team is wants to move forward with basically all of that being let go and given to the Russian Federation.
And the chances of Ukraine allowing that to happen?
Very slim, I would say.
Yeah.
I think that there are somewhat different strategic issues, say in Luhansk and Donetsk, than there are in the southern more regions of Kherson and Zaporizhia. But I think this is something that Zelensky has been really signaling very clearly, that he is not willing to give up those territories.
We've heard from Fred Hoff and Alexander Mihailovich, as well as Terry Gibson, and we now go to Teresa Bourgeois.
I'd really like to ask the two experts here. The U.S. theory on the side of Ukraine, but in fact in these negotiations, as they move through these negotiations, it seems to me have really weakened the hand of the Ukrainians by not only cutting off humanitarian aid, but also cutting off military aid, cutting off some of their lines of sight with access to mapping and a whole host of other things. And Fred, maybe starting with you, as a diplomat, how usual or unusual is it that something like this would happen? It seems to me an odd approach to diplomacy.
That was Teresa Bourgeois on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, March 12th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, March 13th, Joe was joined by Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Bill Hammond, and Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick.
The House of Representatives passed a spending plan, and it was a squeaker. And I think one Republican voted against, one Democrat voted for, right? Something like that. And it passed by the narrowest of margins, three votes, I believe. And that then brought it, sends it to the United States Senate. And then the question was, well, what was the Senate going to do? Because to overcome the filibuster, they would need 60 votes. And that then that puts it into the court of the Democrats to say, well, what are you going to do? And 2 days ago, the headline was, well, Chuck Schumer is playing his cards very close to the vest. A lot of cards in Washington these days. I don't. And so he's playing his cards close to the vest. Yesterday, he announced his hand and said that there would not be Democrats would not be supporting the bill. There would not be enough Democratic support to overcome a filibuster, according to Chuck Schumer. And now he is in saying they're seeking a bill known as a continuing resolution to keep the government open through April 11th while two parties complete work on their long stalled spending bills. So this is the ongoing story of funding the government and where we are right now and what happens if they don't strike a deal within hours from right now. So we'll see what happens. But there was some thought that, okay, the reason that the Republican Congress did this was to throw it into the hands of the Senate, and then that would make the Democrats look bad because they would not support any part of this probably, and then make them out to be the bad guy, which would then still force a shutdown and also, I think, put off the internal debates that would happen within the Republican Party on the House side as to
think spending bills have to start in the House.
Yeah.
So, no matter how they were going to do it, it had to pass the House first.
But but don't you think, is this not correct, that if then it goes to the Senate and then it comes back, it's going to be, if they actually are...
If the Senate does something different, then yeah, it has to go back to the House.
But
is dismissed. The House is not around. They've left the town.
But if the House wants to pass a bill that actually is going to pass, that's going to be contentious, right?
Yes. Yeah. In other words, the Republicans are going to have internal disagreements.
Yes, that's what I was getting at.
Well, I mean, I guess it comes down to what you think the definition of what's going to pass. I think actually the crux of this, the thing that the Democrats are on the firmest ground with, is that they want restraints on the Trump administration and DOGE. Normally, a bill like this would include, as I understand it, language that, you know, the president has to follow our spending plan or something to that effect. In addition, because of what's happening with DOGE, because of all of the, mass layoffs and the apparent impoundment of money where the president is refusing to spend money that was duly appropriated, you might expect Congress would stand up for its prerogatives and say, don't do that anymore, right? That's not what we want. If you want to cut spending, you have to come back to us. They're not doing that either. So that's where I think the Democrats, that's the hill that they have the most room to die on, is, you know, we're the Congress. We should stand up for our prerogatives. We should stand up for separation of powers. Money that was duly appropriated should be spent. It shouldn't be just withheld arbitrarily by the president or by Elon Musk. I think that's where a lot of this is going to be fought out.
Well, don't you think the Republicans have really painted Schumer into a corner? Because he has two choices, and neither of them are optimum for him and for the Democrats. If in fact, they do vote in agreement with the Republicans, they're going to be part of that bill that either missing parts or parts that give too much away, and he doesn't want to do that. On the other hand, if they don't come to an agreement and the government shuts down, then the Democrats are to blame theoretically for the government being shut down.
You know, there's like a technical thing here that I didn't see in the coverage. Why do they have to overcome a filibuster? Is there an actual filibuster that has been called or threatened? Like, I think maybe just any one senator can institute a filibuster. Yeah. They don't have to stand up and speak on the floor anymore, like in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. But couldn't the Democrats just sort of say, look, we're not going to give you any votes, but you guys have a majority of the House.
You own it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess Fetterman said he's ready to vote yes. Rand Paul said he's ready to vote no. So, like, it's a wash. But yeah, I guess I'm just wondering why they have to have the 60 votes. Is there, has a Democrat stood up and said we're filibustering?
I think we're under the delusion that things are normal and maybe they will proceed as normal. Democrats need to be concerned that if they don't pass a bill, if there is a government shutdown, President Trump will use this as an excuse to declare an emergency and do all sorts of things. I think Democrats need to let go of the worry that they're going to be blamed. They're going to be blamed for anything, everything, anytime, everywhere. And the idea, trying to avoid being blamed for a government shutdown is a fool's errand.
Well, so it's really, the important thing is who the public blames.
And the public doesn't care about this, I think. Everything's shutting down anyway. The parks are shut down. I think 95% of Americans have no interest at all in these continuing resolutions and what's happening. I'm not saying that's a good thing, but I think go out in the street and ask anyone. They don't care.
Well, not to be snarky, but when we normally have this conversation, we're talking about the federal workforce not going to work and not getting a paycheck. And now half of them have been fired. So,
that's part of the problem for the Democrats is that their big complaint right now is you're not funding the federal government. You're not enough people are going to work. So how can they vote to make that worse? I mean, there's all kinds of hypocrisy going on here, this is brinksmanship, right? It happens a lot in Washington.
Yeah.
It happens way too often. It is important that the government be allowed to continue operating, but the Democrats have some leverage and it's important for them to try to use it.
I guess, and this is what I was trying to say before, but it was, and tell me if I'm all wet on this, but it seemed like this would not have passed, the Republicans would not have passed this if they thought it was actually going to go through on the Senate because there were such divisions within the Republican Party over aspects of the bill.
I think that's, maybe I don't know enough about this particular bill, but there's two things going on here. There's this is just to keep the government open. And then there's the bigger budget bill that has the Medicaid cuts.
Right.
This particular bill does not, it has some minor cuts, but nothing, it's not the big cuts that are on the table in the other bill.
Well, I don't think, is there a bill with Medicaid cuts? I mean, the Republicans keep denying that they're
going to cut
Medicaid,
okay.
But it's been reported that there's about $8 trillion in cuts that inevitably are going to hit Medicaid and or Medicare. But I don't know that that's been formalized or announced.
There's this overarching framework for a reconciliation process. That includes, I don't know if it's a trillion or more, parts of which are targeted to the committee that deals with health care, including Medicaid. So that's the basis for people worrying about Medicaid cuts. The bill that's sort of urgent now, the bill that keeps the government open, that's a separate piece of legislation that does not include that, as I understand it, does not include the big cuts. And so there's less division in the Republicans. There might be division, but there's less than there would be if what they were voting on was major cuts to Medicaid.
What is Fetterman like about this?
I think he's just taking the position that that we shouldn't shut the government down.
Right, and I think that Democrats need to be better spokesmen. Their messaging is not, once again, their messaging is not clear, is not forceful, is not convincing to the American public about why this is important, what it would mean, and why what their opportunities are. It's such an irrational process. It's just, and it further undermines Americans' confidence in the government in general. I mean, we talk about that overall, but this just is another a nail in the coffin of people believing in our government, believing in our politicians. It's just like, it's over their heads. They don't understand it. And they've gotten to the point where they don't care, especially now when everything else is falling apart. You know, the Social Security, are they going to be able to call and get their information? Are telehealth services going to end on the first of the month of April? I mean, there's so much going on, and adding this to it, it just exacerbates the crisis.
It'd be interesting to go outside on Central Avenue and ask random passersby, what do you think about the reconciliation?
It would be like a David Letterman skit.
I'll let you do that, Bill.
Most people don't know who Schumer is. I mean, or whom pick out of a hat. A lot of people don't know who their own congressperson is. So they, to the extent that they're paying attention, to the analysis of those who they trust and believe, and that's why Fox News gets has a bigger audience by far than anyone else, and their commentary is swaying the opinions of a majority of Americans.
And we welcome you to share your thoughts on our conversation this morning. We're talking about the Senate pushing closer to a shutdown after Democrats spurn a funding bill. Jane writes, Senator Schumer almost appeared to have his hand on it. He almost seemed to be there to actually have a spine yesterday and alleging his and his party's opposition to the continuing resolution. There is no situation where the resolution passes and things will continue okay. The Democrats need to prove they will not be complicit with any more of this insanity. Fetterman's excuse that he doesn't want more chaos seems devoid of recognition that a yes vote will enable and validate more Trump chaos. These bills abdicate Congress's responsibility, and that alone is a reason to oppose on principle and fight to reclaim fundamental checks and balances and accountability for Trump and every member of Congress.
So that's like that's the thing. If you don't like the chaos, shutting down the government creates more chaos. That's kind of the dilemma.
But I think that I think the chaos is inevitable. I hate to be pessimistic about it, but I guess it's the degree of chaos we're willing to accept at this point. But no matter what, buckle your seatbelts because it's going to be chaos for the next 3 years. And
yeah,
I was going to mention this in case the word chaos came up, because I've had a longstanding, but more so recently, concern that the word chaos is overused and everything is chaos or chaotic. And to me, chaos is in the movies when Mighty Joe Young is threatening the city and all the people are running and screaming down the road. This technically fits the definition of chaos, but it's way overused, I think.
I thought you were going to make a Get Smart reference.
Yeah, you're talking about CHAOS or KAOS?
Well, I happen to agree with that letter, that just the word chaos aside, but Schumer has not been, in my opinion, strong enough in general during his tenure, and he showed some spine the other day.
Ruth says to me that everything done by Republicans and especially Trump is transactional. One might also say blackmail. Are the Democrats ever thinking along the lines of what's in it for us if we vote for you? Why does it always seem the Democrats are caught holding the hopeless bag? Then we go to Fred, giving in to the bullies never results in anything but more bullying. The extremist wing of the Republican Party continues to use every means necessary to promote policies and goals that the American people don't want. Yes, they will take some heat in the short term, but it's long past time to stand up.
Allison writes to us and says, I watched a video that Adam Schiff did on the decision to block the budget. I don't recall the exact terminology, but apparently the budget includes carte blanche behaviors by Musk and Trump that he feels will give them six more months of unchecked opportunities. I've heard that before. Then we go to Tom. If ever there was a time for a government shutdown, this would be it.
Why?
I don't know. We'll write back to him and check.
Trump might agree with that, because Trump's seemingly trying to shut down most of the government anyway, and this short circuits it for him.
Right, and he could invoke emergency powers even more powers than he already has. So that is one of the dangers here. What I haven't really seen is an overarching Democratic strategy about how they're going to deal with this. Is the idea that they're just going to let this situation fail and then step in and rescue everything, or are they going to, fight every step of the way? I think they're divided about that. Perhaps a more cohesive approach would help, but maybe division is what they need at this point.
I don't know if anyone needs division, but it's going to be there whether we need it or not, right? I guess that's another issue. Tom says the real ongoing funding crisis is that Congress has not passed a comprehensive budget in almost 30 years.
Yeah, they have not been following their own procedures on that for decades. But you have a dilemma within a dilemma within a dilemma. Like, you have the larger problems of Washington not working well. Then you have a president who's pushing the boundaries of what presidents are supposed to do. And then, you have a closely divided Congress. And then you have this particular vote that's about just continuing the government, keeping it open for, a few more months.
That was Bill Hammond on the Roundtable Panel on Thursday, March 13th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review. On Friday, March 14th, Joe was joined by former EPA Regional Administrator Professor at Bennington College and President of Beyond Plastics, Judith Ank, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marist University, Juris Pupchenix, and Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan.
The issue of the relations between the United States, Russia, and the Ukraine, and of what is ultimately going to happen. The diplomatic effort, the latest seems to be that Vladimir Putin met with U.S. envoy and sent signals for President Trump, according to the Kremlin. The talks in Moscow were with Steve Witkoff. And those talks are about a possible ceasefire in Ukraine. The Kremlin spokesman told reporters on Friday that there was certainly reason to feel cautious optimism about the prospects for a settlement of the war after a flurry of diplomacy in recent days. He was echoing similarly optimistic remarks made by Michael Waltz, Mr. Trump's national security advisor, late yesterday. The comments signaled that Russia was eager to keep negotiating with the United States over Ukraine. On Thursday, before the meeting with Mr. Witkoff, Mr. Putin showed that he was in no hurry to accept the offer of a 30-day truce made by Ukraine and the United States this week. Meanwhile, for Ukraine has agreed to support the U.S.-backed ceasefire proposal, but only if Russia does the same. Volodymyr Zelensky yesterday said that Mr. Putin in his news conference had set so many conditions, quote, that nothing will work out at all, or that it will not work out for as long as possible. All right, Urus, what do we make of all of this?
Oh, God. And first of all, thanks for having me on the show. And I knew I'll be getting questions on Ukraine. And before I give some answers, I just wanted to say also thanks to our listeners for continuously paying attention to this topic. I know how hard it is to pay attention on what's going on in Ukraine after 3 years of the most recent invasion. And I deal with that with my students, too, you know, and they're telling me, you know, like Ukraine, there's a certain tiredness of all these topics and just the focus on Ukraine. But I think it's super important to stay on top of things, what's going on in Ukraine, and for a number of reasons that I can, you know, share and highlight again. Ukraine is not a regular conflict. What happens in Ukraine will have implications for the international system, for the world as a whole. Trump himself will tell you, you know, it can lead to a third world war, and there are a lot of people who would agree with him. So if this conflict is not properly addressed and dealt with, it can lead to a third world war, or if Russia is not properly addressed, it can lead to aggression by countries like Russia in the future. So, I mean, the lessons and implications from Ukraine conflict really wide-ranging. So what is going on there right now? What else can I tell you that you don't know already, right? So there's this peace agreement, or really, I guess, ceasefire, with all these implications that there is also parallel peace agreement that Russia, United States, and Ukraine are working. And then what to make out of this? So the short answer is, I think that it may be the case that if something is reached, if the final agreement is reached, it's going to be via phone call between Putin and Trump. Very interestingly, they both in the last couple of days have said or indicated their willingness to talk to each other. Not only Trump, but also Putin in his response to that proposed ceasefire. So I think, you know, we see this in diplomacy frequently. Once you have these kind of sticky, complicated situations, sometimes leaders head to head will resolve it. Again, the problem here is, where is Ukraine? Ukraine not going to be in that call.
So with the Trump administration pushing Russia to agree on a Ukraine ceasefire, how well do you think that's going to go over? I don't know if it's real or imagined, the level of quote unquote pushback that the Trump administration is giving to Russia on the fact that they want a ceasefire.
Basically, how much leverage Trump or United States really has on Russia?
Yes.
Right. And the answer is really not that much anymore, because think about, like, so many levers have been pushed already. There have been so many, you know, dozens of sanctions and follow-up sanctions by United States, by Europeans. So there isn't much left to sanction in Russia. So what could Trump do? Could he just start to send more weapons to Ukraine? Could he do additional sanctions? I mean, I think the leverage that the United States has is actually rather limited, and you know.
What would a ceasefire? We'll take what we can get, right? But what would a ceasefire ultimately do?
Well, what would ceasefire ultimately do? So Russia has been winning on the battlefield in last couple months, especially last 10 days. Look, they virtually have kicked out Ukraine from Kursk region. Ukraine controls like 10% of what it used to do in that Kursk, Russian Kursk region up north. So at this point, momentum is on Russia's side. So peace agreement would largely go along with the realities on the ground, unfortunately, which means that, you know, it would be favorable to Russia. Russia would get to keep its territory that has occupied, most likely, and Trump already has stated even before negotiations, there is no even talk about Ukraine's NATO membership, which is something that Russia been wanting for a long time.
So then what does Ukraine get out of it? And because they're going to have to cede the land, right? And that's not a win for them, and also
there's little or no, I guess, who other than Zelensky, who is working in their interest?
Right. Yeah.
Well, the rest of Europe is supporting.
Well, that's true. No, yes, but at the bargaining table, right, yeah.
But the issue with all of this is that the rest of the Europe, their argument is this: let's do what we've been doing for the last 3 years and expect different results, which is arm Ukraine, send more and more weapons, more and more money to Ukraine, right? I support Ukraine, but what we see is shortage of soldiers on the Ukrainian front lines, right? Drones are increasingly doing the fighting. As opposed to soldiers, less soldiers and older soldiers. And what is the solution, right?
And I think an underreported part of this war is 20,000 children from Ukraine.
20,000 children, yes.
Brought to Russia, stripped away from their parents.
Yes.
I doubt Trump cares about that, but it would be nice if that was part of the international.
Well, it's true, and we should talk more about that. Speaking about the listener who just wrote in about the short memory of the people who listen to news or follow news, Putin and people around him were indicted on genocide charges. 2 years ago, for taking thousands and thousands of Ukrainian children, mm-hmm. taking them into Russia to be raised as Russians. The latest numbers are about that we know of, and I mm-hmm. wouldn't be surprised it's much greater than that. It's about 20,000 Ukrainian children are taken away from families in Ukraine, away from Ukraine, into Russia to be raised as Russians, right? And under very, very specific genocide definition, that would qualify as genocide.
Well, and they also committed horrific war crimes in an unprovoked invasion of a democratically elected nation. And so, when I was in Ukraine in June, I sat with a woman from Mariupol. They have nothing to go back to. Women and children were intentionally killed there. Our sister city is Bucha, where civilian bodies were left dead on the streets, where they literally hunted for the mayor because they wanted to execute him. And so I hope that our memory isn't so short as to say we are, if we enter into or are able to somehow facilitate and negotiate a ceasefire and ultimately a peace, that we are letting war criminals off the hook, that we are basically closing our eyes to the atrocities that occurred. And NATO exists and was created to prevent Russian aggression, right? Russia seeking to expand its territory. And so the only reason that Russia doesn't want Ukraine in NATO is because it wants to eventually occupy Ukraine. I mean, that's the only reason. So, I mean, NATO wouldn't be a threat to Russia if they did not have territorial ideations around invading other countries and taking them over. Otherwise, why would they care? They'd say, okay, well, we're not looking to be the aggressor here. These are the borders of Russia, and we're going to focus on, we don't need to nation build by expanding into other territory. So, I think that from the standpoint of everything that we stand for as a democratic country and looking back on history, I'm stunned that we are where we are and that we have a president who's willing to say, it's okay. And I think it sets a horrible precedent for the world.
And what I'm stunned that some people see Ukraine as a partisan issue. It's not a partisan mm-hmm. issue. Right, it's not a Democrat or Republican issue. I mean, this is just what the United States does as a country, right? The United States stands up to bullies, stands up to authoritarian regimes.
And I think that the narrative around this was somehow Ukraine's fault. Right, Ukraine provoked this because they wanted to become part of NATO, right? So what we're saying is that because a country wanted the protections to remain a sovereign nation, that they provoked an invasion. That is a bizarro, upside down world where we are being fed propaganda. And people to be fed that propaganda, and for leaders who know better, and for people who absolutely know better to feed that propaganda. What happened at the UN, it is an abomination to everything that our founding fathers and those of us who, you know, have relatives who fought in World War II, fought against fascism, it is an abomination, I think.
You don't have the cards, is what the president said to Volodymyr Zelensky in that Oval Office meeting. I'm curious as to, well, what that means, but also what it, because it tells us a lot of what we were just saying about how much that this is a partisan issue and not an issue of what is right in the world.
You don't have the cards. I mean, that's Trump's point that Ukraine is negotiating from position of weakness. It needs tens of billions of dollars of arms and weapons from the West. But again, that shouldn't have been waste in a public television and right before negotiations, right before Trump knows how the negotiation works, right? That was, you know, meant to weaken Ukraine.
Yeah.
It was a setup, and J.D. Vance played the attack dog role, like J.D. Vance knows anything about Ukraine. I think these are all excellent points, but we also need to go back to the Biden administration was a strong supporter of Ukraine, was sending a lot of weapons, and it just keeps getting worse. But I don't think having Putin and Trump negotiate without Ukraine at the table or without any EU surrogates, I don't see how Ukraine survives that negotiation. Right. Hopefully the bombing and the killing will be subsided. But, you know, let's just remember, you know, Putin is a murderous dictator.
But let's also remember that some of the Republican talking points at the time was that Biden didn't do enough.
Right.
That Biden didn't he put too many controls, right, and conditions on the arms that were sent and what Ukraine could and could not do with them. And when I was in Ukraine, it was interesting because in speaking to, there were a lot of Republicans who were on this trip as well as Democrats. Just these were just citizens who wanted to help Ukraine. And that was the talking point of the Republicans, was that Joe Biden tied Ukraine's hands too much and that he should have given them free rein. And I pointed out that, you know, he was trying to prevent this from escalating to a nuclear war.
Right.
And so everything that was being considered was, is this going to be perceived as the United States attacking Russia as opposed to Ukraine attacking Russia? And, you know, that was where the diplomacy came in. Now we've got Steve Witkoff, who's a billionaire New York real estate developer who, you know, by all accounts was effective in Gaza. And he's now dealing with Russia and he's never had to deal with Russia, but it's being treated as a real estate transaction, really.
And doing business with Russia, doing diplomacy with Russia is not the same as doing diplomacy or business elsewhere.
Can you tell us more why?
Yeah, I mean, this is well known, you know, the layers of lies and deceit and manipulation in Russia through years. I mean, there are like books written about how Russians manipulate and deceive. And I don't know if Witkoff is ready for it. I hope he is. But, you know, he thinks that real estate deals are tough. He hasn't dealt with Russians yet.
And I always have the feeling that Witkoff and Trump are looking out for their own personal financial interest. Is there going to be Trump Tower in Moscow? Who knows what Witkoff is up to? I don't trust him.
Don't you feel that way about most of the issues?
Everything.
Yeah, well, look
at Trump with Gaza. Trump actually says he's going to relocate.
Oh, wow.
And he did that crazy video. And there was a report this morning that Israel and the United States are talking to three East African countries to relocate Palestinians to East Africa so they can clear out Gaza and put up luxury hotels. I mean, I know I sound like a crazy woman, but that actually is what they're planning to do.
So let's go into the Wayback Machine. October 20th, 2016, Democrat Hillary Clinton accused then Republican presidential rival Donald Trump of being a puppet for Russian President Vladimir Putin. This was after Trump had praised Putin as a strong, strong leader and much stronger than U.S. President Barack Obama. So with that very little context, what kind of
Is there a case to be made that there's still puppetry going on between these two men?
There are a lot of conspiracy theories about that.
Yeah.
And right before the 2022 invasion, it's not just Trump. There are a number of folks in the United States on the right who said Vladimir Putin is a strong leader, and look, he stands up for like family rights or religious rights or whatever he was doing. Is Trump a puppet of Putin? I mean, this is more of, I think, I mean, opinion, more of a conspiracy theory kind of territory, I think.
But is it? I mean, seems like a puppet.
But he likes working with authoritarians.
Duarte. Right. Netanyahu.
Yeah.
But you can make the argument that this is because, you know, he can just cut deals with them one-on-one and this tough macho kind of approach.
And I understand your point, and it's well taken. I am asking about the idea of, but does that get us to, God forbid, peace, if Trump seems to be siding more with Russia than with Ukraine or the European allies?
Right. Well, Trump seems to think that he can just go approach negotiations about war in Ukraine or Russian invasion of Ukraine by basically kind of like coming up with a middle ground that he sees as a middle ground and pushing both of them into it. But many, you know, observers say it's more favorable to Russia. And can he get anywhere with it?
Right. And more favorable to Russia, although Russia isn't all that thrilled with it.
Well, that's what they're saying.
Yes. That's what they're saying, right? And you know, and I don't know, like, I'm not original by saying this. Why did Trump up from the get-go said no NATO membership for Ukraine?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, you know, Russians now are negotiating once the proposal is out. Now Russians, you know, the Putin speech yesterday, he says, I like the idea of ceasefire, but I have these questions. And, you know, he can continue pushing this forward. And in the process, he may look Ukrainian side look bad. Maybe he's waiting to conquer Kursk back. You know, Ukraine is still hold about 10%. I mean, who knows what he's doing? But he's negotiating. He's playing that cutthroat negotiation game as opposed to giving up certain points up front.
And for the killing to stop, Zelensky's probably going to have to go along with a lot that he wouldn't want. You know, they had this so-called agreement on rare earth minerals that Zelensky didn't like, but he went along with it to stop the killing of his people. He's going to lose on NATO. He's going to lose on territories. It's going to be a terrible deal for Ukraine, but they are depleted and they don't have an ally in the White House. And so it's almost like Chuck Schumer and the CR. They're going to have to look at the short term and the long term. The status quo isn't working. I mean, I don't know what the answer is, but I certainly don't trust Trump to look out for the best interest of the Ukrainian people. It's a democracy. Why does he care?
My fear is that now that the proposal is out, the ceasefire, Putin will look at it and he'll find ways to make it unworkable and then use the Russian propaganda machine to make Ukraine look bad by inserting some sort of like clauses or demands that are not reasonable. For example, you know, just recently he said that if there's a ceasefire, Ukraine is not to receive any more weapons or recruit more people or train them. You know, I mean, that is not workable proposition.
But not on the Russian side.
But not on the Russian side, right. And, you know, this demand that the Russians have this, you know, occupation of their territory, this Ukrainian troops in Kursk. Well, I mean, you know, it's just like completely spinning the picture. The way Putin talks about it, he's like, our territory is under attack, the 10% of former Ukrainian gangs in Kursk region. But the very point is that Russia invaded Ukraine. Right?
Well, yeah.
And his big complaint is we have occupied, like we have foreign military troops in our land, right? Which is just bizarre.
That was Juris Pupchenyk on the Roundtable panel on Friday, March 14th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.